Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So you've been part of every medium at this point. You've done obviously Broadway and your shows. What excites you the most? Like, is there a particular medium where you're like, hey, I think I want to invest more energy in this direction?
I'm really falling in love with theater again and the possibility of theater. And I'd love to see like Long Day's Journey tonight in an all Latin cast, or Streetcar Named Desire in an all Latin cast, because we have the population in the Triboro area to keep that sucker funded for years. I think it's a great place to be challenged as an artist, because it's the most difficult. It's the Olympics of acting. That's for damn sure. There's no cutting. There's no editing. There's nothing going to save you except your skill set.
On today's episode of Yang Speaks, actor and comedian John Leguizamo is joining. You guys don't want to miss this. He is a fascinating guy. Tune in, John Leguizamo on Yang Speaks right now.
It is my pleasure and privilege to welcome to Yang Speaks my friend, one of the great artists of this era, Tony Award winner, been in, oh my gosh, what is it, man? Like 80 movies.
100 movies. Not all of them good, though.
100 movies. Director, producer, stand-up comedian, John Leguizamo. Welcome, John. It's so great
to
see you.
Thank you, Yang. Thank you.
You've got the Knicks cap on. Am I right that you actually just attended the greatest sporting event in recent memory, which is the Knicks playoff victory in the Garden the other night? Did that happen?
Oh my God, 8 years that we have not been in the playoffs, and this year pandemic, and all of a sudden we're in Madison Square Garden at almost like what, 90% capacity? People, yep. it was screaming and yelling and hollering and loving. I mean, it was incredible, man. The energy was unbeatable. It was better than the game, even though we won.
I want to hear all about this. So first, who did you bring to the game? Did you go with friends? Did you go with family? Like,
my wife, Justine.
Well, this is an incredible date then. This is very exciting. And then do you do the VIP treatment experience, or you just like walk in, or like what did you do?
Yeah, you know, we got a little juice. Yeah, I'm not going to front. We got some swag. So we walk in, we got courtside seats, but you have to test, even though you're double vax or whatever, you still have to test an hour before and test negative. And you still have to wear a mask if you're going to be that close to the players. But, you know, it was fun. I was hanging out with Sting and Victor Cruz. There was a ton of folk there, man. Chris Maloney, John McEnroe and his brother Patrick. Yeah, hobnobbing with the best.
Yeah, because all of New York City is coming out for this game. Knicks being back in the playoffs. You got the courtside treatment. That's incredible. And you and I probably had a similar experience. We can share this for a minute. Where you grew up in Jackson Heights in the Queens area. And so you probably did the same thing I did, which is every once in a while you get lucky and get some like nosebleed seats for like a while. You'd end up. So I remember that very well.
How about the Shea Stadium when it used to be around? Because I'm a little older than all y'all. I'm older than dirt now. And we used to stand on the subway platform to watch and hear the game. Those are ghetto seats.
I remember Shea Stadium. I remember the subway platform and like it being shown on TV and all the fans like, you know, having a good time out there. I remember for the Garden, there was a period, John, where they actually sold $10 Knicks tickets to games. And they went like this. It was in the late 90s, early 2000s. And believe it or not, I managed to get my hands on like some $10 tickets. Mm. And so you'd be there and it was like, you know, the worst seats in the house. But one thing you got to say about the Garden, there really aren't many bad seats. Like you could sit pretty much anywhere in that place.
And it's also when you don't know from courtside, it's all good. It's until you know what courtside and VIP treatment is that then it hurts.
I started out in the nosebleeds. Then every once in a while, a friend who works in, you know, banking or something would be like,
yeah, right, these the
seats. So then you'd like wind up at like, you know, the 200 levels. And then you'd like go back. It's funny. It's that I think that's an experience that a lot of New Yorkers have, which is like, you know, just the random night when your friend calls you and is like, hey, I've got these tickets.
and you got some other great tickets or some other for like Hamilton shit. And then you're like, oh man, not tonight, great courtside Knicks tickets. And I got Hamilton, which I couldn't get, you know, it always happens like that too, when it rains and pours.
That game, I think it might be the largest group of people that have been together in one building or one room.
In New York City in a year. Yep.
Yeah, no, it's wild, man. You were literally like in the place, like the heart of the action.
But safe, but feeling completely safe. Feeling so safe because they have a system, you know? I mean, everybody has to be double vaxxed. Everybody has to be, you know, tested. Everybody's got their masks. You know, you just feel incredibly safe.
So the game you were at, like Trae Young had a great game, but came a little bit short. And I mean, I was stunned in game one when Trae Young hit that game winner and whatnot. And it reminded me of Reggie Miller during the Knicks Pacers days when he became like the villain of the Garden. I was like, honestly, I was like, I did not know Trae Young had this in him.
What a player, man. I know. I didn't know. He's like a Stephen Curry. I mean, he's so good in every position and everything that he's doing. And I know he's follically challenged, but I love that about him too, that the hair ain't perfect and whatnot. It makes him even more lovable because he's got superhuman powers when he comes to b-ball.
Trae is not very big, right? like I've never met Trae.
Well, he still could take both of them.
He seems like normal human size.
He can still take you, Andrew. Don't get...
I mean, I'm not saying he couldn't take the two of us, but I mean, he's 6'1", 6'2"? He seems like a normal human out there among like the trees and whatnot.
He looks tiny. He looks kind of like a hobbit, but he ain't. He'll make us hobbit like.
Are you a Nets fan at all? I mean, you're obviously more hardcore Knicks fan. Like, how do you feel about the Nets?
I'm loving the Nets this year. I mean, I love Kyrie. I love KD. You know, I love their team, man. The team is beautiful. I mean, you know, New York is, we're not allowed to, you know, you have to have your loyalty and you can't even cross. You know, I can't root for the Yankees because I'm a Mets fan. Otherwise, people freak out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know. Sometimes New York is New York. You know, I if we don't make it and the Nets make it, I'm going to go to a Nets game.
I mean, you just want New York to do well writ large.
Right? Because totally. It has repercussions, you know, and you feel it across the city. Even when the Yankees win, the whole city is electric, you know?
Yeah. So you've been at this for quite a while. And one of the things I always love to ask people like you who are world-class creatives is how the heck you got started. Cause I feel like getting started in your field is like the hardest thing in the world. You know, like you grow up in Queens. Yeah. Like you go to the local high school.
Yeah.
You know, in your case, I think you attended NYU for a minute and then dropped out to pursue comedy. I want to say.
Yeah, I mean, being Latin back then and being wanting to be an actor was not the most successful looking choice because, you know, they just didn't cast us. They didn't cast us no matter what. We were always casted out, you know, never made it. You know, like all my white friends that were at NYU studying acting were going to like 5 auditions a day. I was going to 1 every 5 months. So I saw
you must have felt that so acutely because you're in this program and you're like, wait a minute, you know, that like there just aren't as many roles. That's fascinating. That's crazy.
Yeah, and I was able to see it firsthand. I was going, wow, why don't I have the same options? I studied like them. I have the same grades. I studied with better acting teachers than they did. I studied with Herbert Berghoff and Lee Strasberg. Why don't I have the same opportunities? But it's because of the way I look and my name. And that came, you know, became a realization really fast. And then I knew. You know, I started to learn that, wow, this is going to be very difficult. And I need to find other ways to stay, you know, sane and stay creative. So I started writing because that's one place nobody could stop me. You know, nobody could tell me no or exclude me.
So the stuff you started writing initially, was it comedy? Was it jokes? Like, what did you start out writing?
Yeah, you know, I was writing jokes in high school because I had a very competitive comedy table at lunch, and you couldn't sit at the table unless you had the best jokes. And if you didn't have them the day before, you weren't allowed to sit at the table. So it was mad competitive. So I used to have to write jokes to be able to win, because you can't just, you know, be improvising. You're not going to come up with the top joke. So, yeah, so I started writing then. And then by the time I graduated college, I started writing character sketches. You know, I was doing improv at First Amendment, which was this big downtown improv comedy group that was huge. You know, Bruce Willis went there. Robin Williams would come there. And, you know, and a lot of comedians would come there and steal jokes, too. That was a real thing I learned, too.
I mean, some of your jokes, they probably couldn't steal because it wouldn't make sense for them, because I'm sure some of them had to do with being Latino.
Yeah, but people are clever, though. Comedians are clever. They'll know how to flip a joke. Don't make it fit.
So you're scrapping and clawing for a while in the New York comedy scene. Like, when did you feel like, okay, like, this is going to work? You know, like, I'm going to make it, where you started having like some success in getting cast in various roles. Like, what would you consider your own breakout?
My breakthrough moment, when everything just fell into place, was when I did my first one-man show called Mama Mouth in 1990. And, you know, they didn't really believe in my show. They kind of believed in my show, but not really, because I was in the hallway of the theater. I wasn't even in the theater. I was in the hallway of the theater with a makeshift platform, 70 fold-up seats that they would pick up at 8 o'clock when the real show started. And I had to be gone. You know, all my audience had to be cleared out. But, you know, the reviews came in and, you know, they were banging, you know, and all of a sudden in this 70 fold up seats was Al Pacino, John F. Kennedy Jr., Olympia Dukakis, Raul Julia, Sam Shepard, Arthur Miller, John Malkovich. It was incredible, man. And that's when everything started to change, because I think I learned, the audience was learning, the industry was learning, wow, Latin content is valuable. Latin content is for everybody. People want to see Latin people, and Latin people definitely want to see themselves. So it was a breakthrough moment culturally.
It must have been such a small venue, too, where you could literally see their faces. You'd be looking at them being like, hey, look, it's Al Pacino.
It would make me nervous. I would get nervous sometimes because my sight was good then, and I could see those faces. And sometimes, you know, they're not... They're looking at you, but they're getting tired or sleepy or whatever. I don't know. They had a rough night. Yeah, yeah. You know, you see all that. People yawn sometimes. You know, sometimes I'm glad now that I can't see, because all the audience looks like they're really just loving it.
I'm going to tell a random story from running for president that's like my parallel. And, you know, like, it's a little bit later on or whatnot. Yeah. But you have a town hall in New Hampshire and you can see everyone's face. So there's like this like real, like, you kind of know if it's going well or not. It's one reason why you see these various political figures be like, okay, like, change it up, because you see what's working, what's not working. And then I look out there and then it's like Paul Giamatti sitting there, and then I get distracted. I'm like, oh shit, Paul Giamatti's like,
it's too much, town hall in
New Hampshire. And then you like block it out and just continue saying what you're saying. But then there's like part of you that just wanted to stop and be like, hey, you know, like,
right.
Of yours from, you know, like, what, you know, whatever movie I saw you in.
Especially when you see your heroes. It's like when I saw Al Pacino, I was like, you know, I heard myself stammer, because here's your hero watching you perform. It's a little too much. You know what I mean? It's a little too much.
Well, in your case, it must have felt like such an incredible vindication or knighting, where like they're like kind of letting you in the club, where like some people who are heroes of yours, who are world-class New York creatives, actually took time out, saw your show, and then you get all these great reviews for the material. I can see why you're like, wow, you know, like this is working. And you were what, 26 at the time? Is that right?
Yeah, I was 26. And, yeah, they gave me the confidence to keep going. And then, boom, I wrote my next show, Spikorama. And I won Best Play of 1992 at the Warner Hall Award. And, you know, those little wins were really important to me, because it fueled me. You know, it fueled me. And then when my show Mama Mouth hit HBO, then the Latin audience found me. And they would go everywhere. I went Chicago, San Francisco, Texas, wherever I would go, there was a huge Latin audience to be had. And, you know, they just made a church, you know, it would be call and response and yelling and hooting, hollering, and it became electric.
That's beautiful. You must have felt so welcomed by the Latino community the whole time, because you are one of the most prominent voices in my mind in the industry. And when you got started, there was probably a massive void or vacuum you were filling. But, you know, one of the things that reminds me of a little bit is I have some folks who are Asian American creatives, yeah, and whatnot. And some of them also talked about like, hey, I only get cast as the waiter, the gangster, like the,
you know, right.
Like whatever, same, like the Asian American roles are.
I know. I BD Wong used to tell me about those stories, you know, like here's this massively talented young man and, you know, his opportunities are nil, you know, he's just waiting for that perfect Asian role to come along. You know, I love the way Whoopi Goldberg did it. Like when she hit stardom, because she was also a big influence for me. Brilliant, brilliant performer. I saw that her show that Mike Nichols directed on Broadway was life changing for me. But she had them change white roles and male roles to make them a black woman. Just take any script and boom, her recipe was just make it a black woman. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg, that's right. Just make it a black woman. That's a pretty good system. You know, I think people who are listening to this would be like, yeah, let's just like make this into, yeah, an Asian dude.
Right. Because Hollywood didn't understand. Hollywood didn't understand how to write for a black woman. They didn't know how to create that farm to create product for her. So she said, just take a goddamn regular motherfucking script and make it about a black woman. And just, and it worked. It worked.
Yeah. Whoopi and I became friends over the last number of months, you know, through The View during the presidential. She's been great. She's awesome.
She and I got into a lot of trouble. when Al Gore was running for president, she and I did the DNC, and both of us had raunchy material, and we got the DNC in so much trouble because both of us for some reason decided to go like blue and rogue at the same time, and it was too much. Yeah, they couldn't handle it. People of color going rogue.
That's really funny. Those are different times too, and when you show up in person to the DNC, it was probably a very, very boring crew, because I've been to these DNC things and it's not exactly a place for, not exactly a place for edgy humor.
No. It was so wrong, but I learned. I never did. Yeah. I think I did the John Kerry one and I just really toned it down.
That's really funny. You were like, I'm just going to play this one right up the middle.
Yeah. No, it wasn't a place to be raunchy. It was like, oh, my bad. I read the room wrong.
I remember when I was meant to speak at the DNC convention this past year. And you actually feel a bit of pressure because you're like, well, the ratings for this are going to be sky high. And, you know, you were very, very tightly controlled in terms of time. Right. And so we had a speech that we prepared, and then they gave notes, and the only notes they gave, John, were just trying to cut words. They're just trying to like make stuff shorter. It's whatever it is make it shorter. Like substance, like they were cool with the substance.
Yeah.
And then they had me into practice the DNC speech, which is a weird feeling, 'cause you're like practicing speaking to the American people. And they also tell you that, hey, if there's any technical difficulty, we're just going to play this recording. So it was like a weird dress rehearsal where you're like, all right, like, let me like, you know, give my best.
People in the house. Yeah, let me rev up five people in the house as I'm talking to America, and then be prepared to be cut out.
Yeah. Like that's what it was. And then like time passed and it was like the real one. And it was from a studio in New York in that case. And it was like me and Cory Booker were in the same studio. So we were sharing some time and shooting the shit.
How great backstage. Is he, man? Isn't Cory great? I mean, he's got such a great vibe.
Cory's a great guy. This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house.
Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
I feel like a couple of the big movie roles I started, you know, like where you became a household name were Romeo and Juliet and then Moulin Rouge. And I got to say, I was like a big, big Baz Luhrmann fan from back then. You know, so
I don't blame
you. I was
you.
Just curious. Yeah, no, I was curious about whether those experiences stuck out for you in some way. Cause I feel like, you know, the fact that you work with some filmmakers more than once means there's some kind of artistic connection or relationship.
Yeah. I gotta say, I feel very proud of myself that I worked twice and sometimes three times with a lot of filmmakers. I feel like they get me. They get that I'm not about ego or vanity or narcissism. I'm just about the work, and I want to do the best work, and I want everybody to do their best work. And I come to the game to play that way. And with Baz, who's the most collaborative director I've ever worked with, because he wants to know your opinion. He wants to know what you want to add to the situation, and he welcomes it from everybody, from the crew. I've never seen a director work like that, and I borrow from him greatly. And he rehearses a lot, which is another really important thing that only the great directors I've seen do. Like Spike Lee did it with us with Summer of Sam. He rehearsed for 2 weeks. Brian De Palma also rehearsed this for Casualties of War and Carlito's Way. The great directors know. I mean, it's mostly for theater, but nobody else does it. And for Moulin Rouge, we did a month rehearsal. Like I had to learn
wow.
how to speak with a sort of English accent in the lift, because Toulouse Lautrec was a product of two first cousins. So his lips and tongue were kind of like cartilagey. And then he had weak ankles. He had a lot of physical issues being the product of two first cousins. So there's a lesson for anybody and everybody, you know, don't mess around with family that way. But working with Baz, I mean, it's incredible, man. I mean, some of the scenes had 21 angles. So you had to do it like 40, 50 times, wow. which is really intense. And then you saw that final product. I mean, Moulin Rouge is brought the musical back. It'd been dead since 1972. Grease was the last successful musical, 1972. And here he is bringing it back 2000, and it came back.
So you've been part of every medium at this point. You've done obviously Broadway and your shows. You've been like the voice of Ice Age and the rest of it. You've been in movies, you've been in TV. At this point, I feel like you could do anything. Like what type of role, whether it's like director, producer, writer, like what excites you the most? Like, is there a particular medium where you're like, hey, I think I want to invest more energy in this direction? Because at this point, I feel like people are going to want you for like, you know, like all of the above. Like, is there a particular area that you're more excited about?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I'm really falling in love with theater again and the possibility of theater. And especially because I'm in New York City and I just had so much success in LA and New York, to bring theater. I would love to see like Long Day's Journey Tonight in an all Latin cast, or Streetcar Named Desire in an all Latin cast, because we have the population in the Triboro area to keep that sucker funded for years. Look at my dog back there. Oh, wow. Looks like a corpse. Looks like a corpse.
Yeah, no, road man, kill. I wouldn't even road know when I was alive.
Animatronic. But yeah, I would love to go back to theater. I think it's a great place to be challenged as an artist, because it's the most difficult. It's the Olympics of acting. That's for damn sure. There's no cutting. There's no editing. There's nothing going to save you except your skill set.
Well, one of the things that I talk to folks like you about is that I've discovered parallels among politics, comedy, performance of different types. And so I've been asking folks like you, if someone were to run for a Senate or president from the creative fields, like who might you pick out and be like, oh, that person could do it? So to preface this, I'll tell you about a couple of people who have been called out to me in this direction. Someone said John Stewart. Someone was like, John Stewart could do this at like a very, very high level. Another person nominated Chris Rock.
Why not? Alec Baldwin, man. I think Alec has the chops, the intelligence, the savvy. I mean, he's just so well-rounded, you know what I mean? And he's got
that's a great choice.
Especially because he played
the president over and over again. And at this point in our country, I feel like if you play the president, that's like halfway to
it's like advertising for you.
So you're investing in theater. There's like a show that I want to say that you're in right now or soon to be. Is it like a Waiting for Godot revival with Ethan Hawke?
Was that
a short run?
Yeah. It's the first time the play has ever been allowed to be filmed, and it's only allowed to live on this platform for 3 weeks, and then we have to destroy it because the estate.
You have to destroy it?
It's not allowed to continue. It was a one-time only thing because of the pandemic and the situation we're living, that the estate, the Godot estate, the Beckett estate, allowed us to film it because it's never been allowed to be filmed. And you know, there are a lot of rules. Like, we're not allowed to cut the script. You're not allowed to change any words. You have to stick exactly to what Beckett wrote. So we had that. But I thought Ethan Hawke was incredible in it. Wallace Shawn is so beautiful. Tariq kills it. I think this is one of the best Godot versions I've ever seen. Not just because I'm in it, but because sometimes it gets a little too silly, the play, for me. It gets a little too ridiculous, and you just lose all the values. We really researched a lot and tried to understand that Beckett wanted the depressing elements to live, the anger, the being lost, because it's right after the war. So people were hungry, they were homeless, they were lost, you know, everything had been destroyed. Europe was bombed all over the place.
This does sound like kind of familiar to our time a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, we're coming out of it. Yeah,
exactly, Andrew. Exactly. That's why we did it now, because we felt it was such a parallel to our feeling, you know, jobless and confused and alone and isolated, kind of like the way people felt after World War II.
So the shows that you have in mind for New York City, it sounds like they would have Latino, Latina cast involved. Are there particular productions you have your mind moving towards? Like, are there things that we can look forward to, I suppose, or is it in the planning stages still?
Oh, no, it's still in the planning stages, but, you know, I'd love to see A Long Day's Journey Tonight, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, for the all Latin cast, Death of a Salesman. Yeah, I want to see the classics with Latin people in it, because I think it would really change everybody's perceptions of Latin life and Latin people, you know, and seeing performers. And we know we have the crowds, you know.
You have Latin the people. Talent, that's for sure. You have the talent.
Oh, yeah, we definitely got the talent, you know, and we definitely have the audience. I mean, we're equal to whites in population in New York City. And so we got the numbers. Just a matter of, you know, convincing the estates, because everything is controlled by estates.
Fascinating. Well, you're one of the pioneers who proved that the audience was there. And it must be incredibly heartwarming for you to see this generation of performers that's come after you, because I feel like you were one of the trailblazers in the Latino community. And then there are all these folks that have been following your footsteps. Obviously, everyone has a different take and a different flavor. But do they see you and then they all say to you, it's like, hey, you made me think I could do this? Like, I bet you get that a lot.
I do, and it just fed my soul, man. It fed my soul in so many ways, because, yeah, I felt very alone. You know, I was the only Latin guy in my acting classes. I was always like the only one. And then when we'd go to auditions, it'd be like five of us all, you know, dressed up as gangsters to play the next murderer.
that's not a good feeling. You're like showing up, no. Like, hey, you're like the
all of us like with chains and, you know, camouflage and talking like, yo, what's up, man? What's up, man? You know what you're doing? Louis Guzman would be there, and Benicio Toro, Benjamin Brad would be the same cats. And then if it was a janitor, he'd be there also, like in blue, you know, overalls, going, how are you doing? Like, good to see you. Thank you very much. Everything good? Yeah, good. You know, all of us working on our Spanish accents. But, you know, it was kind of a lonely situation. And there was a lot of glass ceilings and stingy tokenism back then. And to see all these new Latin cats and girls and young and older getting opportunities that they deserved, you know, all, not squandering dreams and not wasting all this talent, which I saw for so many years happen.
Well, I think that the lesson you took early on, which is just to write your own material, I think is a really powerful one. Because if you show up to someone else's vision, you're like, wait a minute, like this vision's a pretty narrow conception of what Latins can do or are. And it's like, let's try and broaden it. I mean, one of your most impactful works was, I want to say it was like Latin History for Morons or something like that.
You got it.
Oh, good. Look at that. I got that right.
You know, you got the power.
Oh, thanks, John. But, you know, I saw that and I have to admit, like, even looking over your body of work, I was like, wow, there are so many lessons here. Like, you really blazed a trail that I feel like other communities could learn from and benefit from.
America was not really just created by white people, as Stephen King or some of those Republican white supremacists want to believe and keep saying. It was built by all of us, you know, by all people of color. Latin people, we've always been here because we had great empires here, Aztec, Mayan, Incan, Southwest tribes that became Mexico. And then, you know, California, all the Southwest was Mexico till 1840s. So we've been here forever, man, contributing to America. You know, we're the only ethnic group that's fought in every single war America's ever had. I'm talking about American Revolution, wow. Civil War. There was 10,000 unknown Latino patriots that fought in the American Revolutionary War. And we donated, Juan Miralles of Cuba got $2 million donated to George Washington to fight the war from Cuba, Mexico, incredible. And Spain. But, you know, but it's not in history textbooks. And now that they don't want to, you know, Republicans don't want to include us in their textbooks, they want to just keep it all whitewashed in Texas. It's a real shame. And hopefully we can kill this filibuster someday, you know, soon, because we're running out of time. So we can maybe override some of these things.
I agree with you there. The filibuster is stupid and it's self-imposed. Yes, like, yes, there's nothing in the rule book. Like,
can I quote you, Andrew?
yeah, you can.
I love totally. It. The filibuster is stupid. It is.
It genuinely is.
Yeah, it wasn't even the founding fathers didn't even have it. It was made up by the Senate.
Nowhere.
During the Jim Crow years. Yeah.
It's an arbitrary House rule. Oh, I mean, when I say House, I mean, it's an arbitrary Senate rule he's came up with. And it's just been like, you know, living on and on and on. And if you got to ask yourself, it's like, what body would try and make it harder for them to do their job? You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like, it's hard enough to get a majority of senators to do something. It's like, hey, let's have a super majority be necessary instead, just for like no real reason.
Right.
Like,
so that 35 people can obstruct what America wants constantly. It doesn't make any sense. The founding fathers would have never came up with such a ridiculous rule.
Yeah, they didn't. You know, it's just the Senate decided to adopt it and they can unadopt it. And everyone agrees, interestingly enough, that all you need is a majority of senators and you can get rid of the filibuster. That's actually except
Joe Manchin and Sinema.
Oh, no. If you need them to get on board. But if you had 51 senators or 50 with Kamala as a tiebreaker, then you could get rid of the filibuster. And they should get rid of the filibuster. We're running out of time. I completely agree with you.
We got we got about 200 days, about that, right? Till the election for the 2020 midterm elections. And if we lose the House and the Senate, we're done.
Yeah, we got to maximize the impact right now. I couldn't agree more. It's one reason I went to Georgia to try and win those seats. And
oh, good for you, man. You did it.
Like, freaking maximize. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for that. It's very important. Like you taking the responsibility of making a change, because that's how change happens, is if we all put it on our backs.
Yeah. So on that topic, I'm going to share my own story and I just want to hear your story on this side. So I'm the son of immigrants, Asian American immigrants. And I tell people, my family did not talk about American politics a whole lot in my household. And it was certainly not presented as something that my brother and I should pursue professionally. That was not the message. And one of the things that I saw recently was that both Asian Americans and Latinos are the most underrepresented in terms of elected officials of any communities in country. We were neck and neck with each other, by the way. It was like Asians are the most underrepresented. Latinos were like right there next to it. And part of that is that we don't engage politically at the same level as other communities. And that's like a fairly consistent strain. And I share with people, it's like, look, my parents didn't talk about this stuff either. I'm not even sure like who they voted for, what was going on. And so you are very, very politically active. I'm obviously very politically active. Like, do you see something similar in the Latino community in terms of engagement? And then like, how did you get so activated in politics if you had the same kind of experience I did? Maybe you didn't, because maybe your family was more into it than mine was.
You know, I'm an immigrant myself. You know, I was born in Colombia and I came here when I was 3 years old. So I'm a son of immigrants and I'm an immigrant. My family didn't really talk a lot about politics either, but my mom became political when I was in my 20s because she saw that in Queens that Latin kids were not getting the library help that they needed. They weren't getting the food services they needed at school. The schools didn't have the supplies they needed. And it broke my mom's heart. So she got very political back then. And she even stomped for AOC. When AOC was stomping in Queens, my mom was there with her friends and they all helped her. I think the Latin community has been very political. It's, you know, Jim Crow laws were for Latin people too in the 1830s. It was all over the Southwest, you know, no dogs or Mexicans allowed, no Spanish allowed to be talked, you know, children in the Southwest in some schools were made to write their Spanish words and to bury them in the ground so they would never speak it again. And this has been talking about the 1800s, all this stuff. And you know, there were a lot, there were governors in Texas who were Mexican, who helped flip Texas to America. And then as soon as they won, they booted them out, said they were traitors and we couldn't trust them. So I think we've been politically active, just not included, not allowed. You know, poll taxes were for Latin people in Texas as well. You know, we're the second most lynched people in America. 6,000 Latinos were lynched, shot, burned alive from 1830 to 1930. You know, we've been denuded. We've been gassed. There's this thing called the Bath Riots of 1919, where immigrants were the gold standard from Latin America to come here and work and, you know, clean and farm. And but they would make them separate the men and the women, make them both get naked. And then they would spray them with a Zyklon gas. And the Nazis borrowed from this. You know, they would cut their hair, you know, shave their head if they had lice. And then the riots happened because a 17-year-old girl said, she did not want to go through that denuding, degrading process anymore. So, yeah, you know, we've been through a lot of oppression. We've been here politicized and trying to fight. But, you know, it was always incredibly difficult and to a peril to our own lives.
Well, hopefully we can change that and make it easier. And it is true that right now there's a movement around the country trying to disenfranchise people. You know, like people are redrawing districts in very dark ways. And, you know, there's a very basic principle that most people would agree with, which is voters should choose lawmakers, not the other way around, which is right now lawmakers are trying to choose voters. It's a very destructive approach to governing. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people that are heading that direction and it's affecting Black and Brown voters the most. You know, one of the things I learned in Georgia is that Asian Americans were like the, you know, new swing vote in part because they were like the more recent arrivals there. And I was stunned at how many Asians were in Georgia, truly. I mean, I was there to activate any voter. Like I walked around with MLK3, but I got to say, like, I was like, this is like enormous Asian neighborhood. The food is delicious. Like, you know, all this stuff. I had a blast down there. I mean, it was really sad when, you know, the six Asian women were shot horrific. In that area. Horrific. Like, because I felt like I'd actually walked through those neighborhoods, but they're trying to
so sad.
You know, the voting laws in Georgia in the same way, and it's like a terrible response. Like you lose a race, and then it's like, well, like time to make it harder to vote,
right?
And,
you know, like, yeah. Instead of let's come up with some new ideology, let's come up with some new you know, mottos or logos that'll turn people on. No, let's
more ideas or policies, or maybe we should have a change of heart. Instead, it's like, oh, let's change the voting laws. And when I was in Georgia too, John, like the ads were so fear-mongering. It was crazy. It was literally like, you know, vote for David Perdue to save America.
Right.
And then there would be an image of John Ossoff like standing with a bunch of black people. And it was like, like the whole so thing racist. Was so, it was so
offensive. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to say, yeah, like when I was there, I was like, we got to win this race just to show like that this messaging doesn't work. And the messaging didn't work, but it came really close. I mean, those races came down to, you know, about 1% of voters. So it was like,
but luckily Trump thought he was like working for them by saying that, you know, elections aren't fair, but he turned off his own.
Yeah. The whole thing.
He turned off his own people. He turned his people off from voting, which was incredible. I was like, oh, I'm so glad that shit backfired on him. It made me so happy.
Yeah, it was wild, man, because like I was celebrating those victories, being like, oh my gosh, we won the Senate. And then terrible things out of DC, like, you know, I think it was literally later that day where like friends in Congress, I'm like texting them being like, you all right? And then they're like freaking hiding in various rooms. We, like you said, we don't have that much time. We got to activate people, get some laws passed, get rid of this filibuster, do as much good as we can in the time we have, because there are a lot of Americans that have just lost a lot of confidence or faith, you know, that we can actually make some positive change. You're all about positive change. It's one reason I love you. It's one reason why so many people love you. I think that there's something really important to art, creativity, film, like all this stuff, like culture. Like, you know, that, I mean, there are people like you that are sending out these incredibly positive messages and products where like, you know, it's elevating, like people feel from you that great things are still possible. And I feel like that's needed more than ever. Like, I think it's going to be crucially important in New York City. I think it's going to be crucially important all throughout America. I'm so grateful to be talking to you and have this conversation with you and to consider you a friend, because you are one of the greatest creatives of our time.
Thank you, Andrea. I love you back, man. I feel like you're such a powerful voice for all of us, and for the Asian community, for the Latin community, for the Black community. I mean, we're all one people, really, you know, and we're stronger together. And I really believe that. I believe all of us working together is such a powerful force. It's such a hopeful message and the way society functions at its best. I mean, why is New York City one of the greatest cities in the world? Because look at all of us. It's not a monolith. Yes. You know, it's multicultural, and this melting pot and cross-pollination of nationalities, religions, cultures is so beautiful. And so, you know, it just makes everything so creative and so hopeful.
Amen. That's a beautiful vision of New York City. Let's make it a reality as quickly as we can.
Yeah.
John Leguizamo, thank you so much, brother.
Thank
appreciate
you,
the
big
heck
hug,
out of you.
Love
and you, I will see you very soon. Love you too, brother.